Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the Middle East. And what we want to do here at the beginning, at least, is to talk a little bit about the impact of the global economic downturn on the Arab world. And it turns out that it's maybe not a simple question to answer in this sense. When you ask the question, how has the downturn affected the Arab world, you have to say, well, what country are you talking about? Because it's different from one place to another. We'll try to talk about some of the trends across the region, perhaps give some specific examples of countries where a loss of income has indeed affected their policies, and perhaps get into some other issues as well. And our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Michelle Dunn. She is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She is an expert on Arab politics and U.S. policy, formerly a specialist at the State Department and the White House on Middle East affairs. She's also been visiting assistant professor of Arabic language at Georgetown University. She has done research on political, economic, and social reform in the Middle East, and also U.S. policy toward the Middle East and the Muslim world. If you're interested in learning more about her, perhaps seeing more of her thoughts on various issues, you can find her at the website of the endowment, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So if you have internet access, you can go right there. Questions are welcome here, too. We ask, however, that people who are calling in are brief in their comments and questions so we can keep moving along. And please do stay focused on the topic. But otherwise, you are certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Dunn, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I think just as to start in a general way, I think if you ask this question, well, how have Arab countries done in the recent downturn? It turns out that they have fared better than some other places, or maybe the other way to say it is they have not been hurt as much as some other countries. But you do have to ask, well, what country are you talking about? And in particular, I guess it makes a big difference whether you're talking about a country that is an oil exporter or a country that is an oil importer.
That's right, David. I mean, we, of course, when we think of the Arab world, we think immediately of the oil issue. Mm-hmm. And certainly because of the large drops in oil prices, some of the countries are feeling that very keenly. But some of the oil exporting countries, such as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, learned a very difficult lesson during the 1980s when oil prices fell sharply. And so during the recent oil boom, many of these countries saved or invested huge sums for a rainy day, which allows them now to institute stimulus packages and fund their national budgets, despite the fact that their oil revenues were very low. They also planned their national budgets for this year and the coming year on really conservative oil price estimates. So those countries, while they certainly feel the difference, they're not hurting as much as one might expect. And then there are also some other Arab countries, such as Syria, Libya, Yemen, that are not that closely tied into the global economy, and so they've felt the immediate repercussions of the crisis less. But there's a third category of Arab countries that don't have much oil revenue, and so they're not feeling the oil price change so much, but they are feeling the effects of the crisis because they are highly dependent on certain forms of revenue, like remittances from workers from their country working in the oil exporting countries. A country like Lebanon, for example, is very dependent on worker remittances. Some of the Arab countries are very dependent on tourism. Egypt and Morocco, for example, and those countries have taken a big hit, of course, because the tourism is way down. Some countries, particularly in North Africa, are very dependent on trade with Europe. Tunisia is a good example of that. And some countries are very dependent on foreign direct investment, whether from the Gulf countries or the West. Jordan is a good example of that. And so these countries are a little bit more vulnerable to external shocks. And so they're feeling the crisis right now more than some of the others.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the things that maybe will surprise people is that there are some countries in the Middle East that are actually oil importers. And I suppose when you think about the Middle East, what do you think of? You think of as oil, that oil and natural gas is the basis of their economies. And in some countries, that is the case. But it's not the case in all countries.
That's certainly true. And there are some countries, Egypt is a good example of this, or Syria, they have small quantities of oil and gas, but they basically end up using most of it themselves. They really, they're not exporting large quantities. It's really the countries of the Gulf, as Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, and also Algeria and Libya in North Africa, that have pretty big quantities of oil and gas that are exporting and therefore are bringing big revenues into the government.
Mm-hmm. Something that I think is very striking, if you look at the base of the economy generally as a region, you will see that it's actually pretty small in the sense that the big industries are natural resources, oil and natural gas. Tourism is another, because some of the economies of these countries have really been booming. Construction has actually been a big business. But there really isn't much else other than that. There's not much manufacturing to speak of, not on any kind of large scale. And I wonder how it is that people in the region think about the fact that their economies are built on essentially that it's a like a stool with three legs. That's pretty much what there is.
Yes, these economies are largely still, what are known as rentier economies, where the state is receiving rents of some kind. If, for example, the natural resources, or even some economists argue that even tourism is a form of rent, so to speak. In other words, that you have these resources such as antiquities or beautiful seashores or whatever, and you're able to milk them for revenue. This is as opposed to creating wealth by manufacturing goods and so forth. The reports that have been put out by the United Nations Development Program, it has recently put out a series of reports called the Arab Human Development Reports, and they noted this very low level of productive activity of manufacturing in the Arab world, much, much lower than European countries.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the fact that, for example, in places where they do have significant oil resources, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, that they realized that there could be a big drop in the price of oil. And so what they were doing was putting money aside. And in fact, what they now have done during the downturn with the decline in price of oil is that they have had some significant cash resources that they can draw on. And so they have been actually doing what a lot of other countries have been doing, is they have put into place economic stimulus plans. And so they actually have the money to spend. But not everybody does. Are there other sorts of really significant, in terms of domestic policies, what happens within the borders of particular countries, things that particular governments have done that were, let us say, dramatically different from what they had done in the past, that has been a response to what's going on globally with the economy?
Well, as you noted, some of the countries foresaw that there would eventually be a decline in the price of oil, and maybe some even saw this real estate bust coming and so forth. But they were being conservative during the boom, and they were planning. And some of the countries, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, actually have in the bank several years of their government's budgets just sitting there. Their planned expenditures are sitting there. So that they're well placed. In other countries, the policy responses to the crisis have differed, but some of them have had to take, I think, what they consider to be emergency measures. Egypt is a good example of this. Egypt has really increased social welfare spending, salaries for government workers, for example, very, very large numbers of government workers in some of these countries, and subsidies for basic foodstuffs, because they are worried about unrest. They're worried about a social explosion if people's standard of living goes too low. So in a country like Egypt, unfortunately, this is slowing down and possibly even derailing, at least temporarily, an economic reform program. The government had wanted to move away from the subsidies system. You know, right now the government subsidizes to some extent energy and basic foods like bread, sugar, oil, and so forth. And everyone in the country, rich and poor, benefits from these low prices. In Egypt, they wanted to move away from that and move to a regular system of welfare payments where they would identify the poor people and give them payments, as happens in the United States and other countries, rather than subsidizing goods for the entire population. But they've had to shelve those plans. And in fact, they've had to significantly increase what they're putting in their budgets for subsidies and salary increases and so forth, because they're worried about the stability implications otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, this gets at something that I was interested in trying to talk about, and among the things I have looked at here in trying to get ready for our conversation was an interesting piece that appeared in The Economist not very long ago. Sort of the thrust of the article was that if you take a look at the region over the past couple of decades, you'll see two dramatic things. One is that there has been almost no change in politics, in the sense that the people who were leading a lot of these countries 20 years ago are still there. And at the same time, there has been, however, a significant change in the societies of these countries. And one of the things that's pointed to, and this is not a new kind of idea, is that we have growing percentages of the population that are young. So we have population growth, particularly in the younger cohorts, people who have expectations. And the challenge is, well, how is it that these governments are going to meet the expectations of all of these people? It has apparently led a lot of analysts of the region to predict that the Arab world, in a sense, is on a precipice, that at any point, anywhere, we could have a kind of uprising, and it's based on the very thing, the other thing that I mentioned. That is, you know, we have a lot of people, we have a lot of young people, we have people who have expectations for a certain kind of life, and there's this feeling that their governments aren't really doing very much to try to fulfill those expectations.
Well, I believe you're speaking of what was, I think, an excellent report in the July 25th Economist about the Arab world called Waking from Its Sleep. Mm-hmm. And I really recommend that to the listeners. It's a great sort of just snapshot of what's going on in the Arab world today. And I think The Economist was very wise in sort of identifying some of these nascent trends, because it's true, you can look at the region and say, well, not much has changed, most of the same people and certainly the same political systems are in power, with the exception of Iraq and a few other places, as was the case 20 years ago, and really nothing's happening in the Arab world. But I agree with what The Economist said, that there's a lot happening underneath the surface. And this is something that my own publication, the Arab Reform Bulletin, writes about a great deal. We're getting a lot of articles from authors from the Middle East discussing these topics. There is, as you mentioned, David, a very large youth bulge in the Arab world, and the biggest concern for Arab governments is providing employment. Unemployment is already high. It's already well over 10% in many Arab countries, but among young people, among under 30, let's say, it's often 20-25% in countries. So that's a very large unemployment problem. Now, it's also not new, really. This has been going on for some time. And it's something that every government in the Middle East worries about, even the wealthy countries. This is even a problem in places like Saudi Arabia, at least, except this is perhaps not a problem in the oil-exporting countries that have tiny populations. But Saudi Arabia, for example, is an oil exporter that has a pretty big population, about 20 million people. And they youth unemployment is a problem even in Saudi Arabia. So the governments are always trying to figure out what to do about this. It's a complex problem, and one of the aspects of it is there's often a mismatch between the qualifications of people entering the labor force and the jobs that are available. Arab educational institutions are simply not providing young people with the skills they need, scientific skills, technical skills, foreign language skills, critical thinking and writing skills. These are the jobs that are being generated by the global economy, and employers in the Arab world, or certainly multinational corporations who try to employ people in the Arab world, often complain that they have jobs to offer, but they just can't find the right people, or they have a very hard time finding the right people. So education is part of the answer to this. Some of the Arab countries, those with resources, have taken this on in a very serious way. In countries like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, and even now to some degree in Saudi Arabia, we see a big emphasis, especially on higher education, university education, and actually developing partnerships with a lot of foreign educational institutions. Many, many universities in the United States, American education, the American educational philosophy and approach particularly is highly valued in the Arab world, and some European universities as well. So the countries that have the money to do it are trying to address this problem. There's one more thing I want to say about youth unemployment, though. Mm-hmm. I would be cautious about predicting a near-term explosion because of the youth bulge and youth unemployment. The unfortunate truth is that people in the Arab world are used to this. It's been going on for some time. And the positive side of that is that the family tends to be very strong in the Arab world, and the extended family provides a safety net for these young people who are not employed, and provides to some extent things for them to do, and parents are very ready to support children throughout their 20s and so forth and into their 30s even until they find their place in the workforce. There have been some social scientists who've written about this who've even identified in the Arab world this period that often happens between childhood and adulthood, which they call waithood. People in their 20s, for example, who are waiting for their adult lives to begin, waiting to find jobs, waiting to be able to have the resources to get married and so forth. So it's a well-known phenomenon, and people are finding ways of coping with it.
Yeah. I would think that also for the issue for some of these governments would be, they would be concerned that their best people would seek opportunities elsewhere. Now, I don't want to make it sound as if, I'm sure that that's not as easy as it sounds, but that at the same time, is there that kind of worry that their smartest, their most ambitious, their most able citizens, particularly young people, if they can, they'll simply leave the country and go someplace else?
Well, yes, and that I think that's been you know, a discouraging phenomenon for a lot of Arab government leaders. I mean, there have been a lot of polling data that shows in many Arab countries there are just large numbers of young people who would certainly leave if they had any opportunity to do so. There's been a long-term phenomenon of people from the poorer Arab countries, from Egypt, the other North African countries, from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and the Palestinian territories going to the Gulf, going to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries and earning money there and, you know, giving their expertise to those countries. I don't think the wealthy countries have so much of a problem with their young people leaving. So, yes, there's sort of a transfer that goes on with the poorer countries sending people, including, and this is everything from, from unskilled workers all the way up to highly qualified people with technical and academic higher degrees and so forth, and judges and all kinds of very highly qualified people going to work in the Gulf countries. Now, some of those people, you know, are going to be, you know, having a difficult time now because of the lower oil revenues. But there is a brain drain problem in many Arab countries.
Let me introduce again our guest. We're growing close to the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. Michelle Dunn is Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she's also editor of the Arab Reform Bulletin. She's an expert on Arab politics and U.S. policy, formerly a specialist at the State Department and the White House on Middle East affairs. She's also been visiting assistant professor of Arabic language at Georgetown University and has done research on political, economic, social reform in the Middle East, also on U.S. policy toward the Middle East and the Muslim world. And again, if you'd like to read more about her, see some of the things that she has written, and get more of an idea of what the Carnegie Endowment is all about, you can go to their website. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Just again, going back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about how the economies of the region, generally speaking, have a fairly narrow base. Resource extraction is a big part of it. Tourism is a part of it. Construction has been a part of it. Are there efforts in these capitals of these countries to try to expand their economies, to try to perhaps develop homegrown industry, some kind of manufacturing, something other than the other big three?
Yes. And particularly in the oil exporting states who had these large windfall revenues in recent years, there has been a serious effort at two things, at diversification of the economy and also at employing more of their own citizens in the economy, as opposed to bringing in all kinds of foreign workers, whether they're from Arab countries, South Asia, from the West, all kinds of places. Now, some of the countries have been pretty successful in going into industries that are related to the petroleum exports. I mean, petrochemicals, for example, is a big industry in the Middle East, and so they've tried to sort of play off their strength in having these oil resources and develop related industries. Some of them have become, for example, in the United Arab Emirates in particular, have become financial and banking centers. They've tried to have developed their financial sectors a good deal. There are a few countries that have made a more serious attempt at manufacturing. Tunisia, a small country in North Africa, that really doesn't have much in terms of oil resources. It does have revenue from tourism, but they have a more serious manufacturing sector than many Arab countries, and they rely heavily on exports to Europe. So there have been some attempts at this. People have thought about it more seriously than in recent years, but it's still the region is a long way away from having a really well-developed, diverse kind of economic base.
We have a caller here, someone who is on a cell phone in Champaign, so let's bring them in. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. So
yes.
This question may be better put to a historian rather than your current guest, but maybe 400 or 500 years ago, the Arab world was the seat of arts and sciences, and its influence, for example, in southern Europe and Spain, the architectural influence, especially the influence in mathematics and astronomy. I guess my question is what happened from that period to the present day? So I'll hang up, and if the guest has a can discuss this. I'd enjoy hearing about it. Thank
All right.
you very much.
Well, I appreciate Bye-bye. The comment. This is a question I think that over the last couple of years, a number of books have been written on this subject. People have been talking a lot about this. Do you have a thought about that?
Yeah, it is. It has been the subject of hot debate, and there's been a lot of speculation as to whether there was something in the nature of Arab culture or in Islam as a religion, or why did did the Arab world sort of not go through a renaissance and so forth? Because as the caller correctly identifies, the Arab world had a rather glorious medieval period and was much more advanced than Europe, and Europe was taking technological and science and cultural and all kinds of developments from the Arab world rather than the other way around. The Arabs played an extremely important role, for example, in rediscovering and preserving the cultural heritage of ancient Greece and so forth, and in sort of conveying that to Europe, and that became, of course, such an important part of the European Renaissance. One of the things I would attribute this sort of stagnation that set in the Arab world to is the perhaps the Ottoman Empire. It sort of coincided with the spread of the Ottoman Empire based in Turkey throughout much of the Arab world, and the Ottoman Empire over time as a system of governance became more and more sort of corrupted and weakened and very, very inefficient. And so that's something I think that's a theme that we also see today. I mean, there are also many discussions about why the Arab world suffers from some of the problems it does today, because the Arab world did kind of have another awakening in the 19th century and the early 20th century, and we saw a lot of a growth in sort of science and literature and even religious thought and all kinds of things and political institutions and so forth. And then it all kind of stagnated again somewhere in the early to mid 20th century. So this problem of sort of political systems that are not adaptable enough, are not representative enough, are repressive in some way, has been a continuing, a repeat theme in Arab history. And again, I want to mention the Arab Human Development Reports. When the first one came out in 2003, it was a bit of a stunner. This is a report put together by Arab intellectuals under United Nations auspices, and it talked about three deficits in the Arab world: a freedom deficit, a deficit in education, and a deficit in women's empowerment. And they were all kind of linked, and the report portrayed the repressive governing systems in many Arab countries as really holding back very important things in education, for example, discouraging a culture of knowledge and exploration and critical thinking and so forth. So I think this deficit in freedom and this relatively less development in political systems has been one of the things that has held the Arab world back.
Well, here, this is exactly the next point I wanted to go on to, and forgive me for going back again to this piece that was in The Economist, but one of the points that they make right up front here is just how stable the leadership in the Arab world has been over the past couple of decades, listing, for example, the fact that Hosni Mubarak has been president of Egypt for 28 years, and it seems like he's getting ready to hand off the job to his son. In Syria, Hafez al-Assad was in power for 30 years. He handed the job off to his son, and we have rulers in a number of other places that have been in power for more than 20 years, more than 30 years, and then places where families, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, have been in power for a long time, and really makes you wonder, is that going to change anytime soon?
Well, and by the way, I think the leader of the pack is Libya, where Gaddafi, now this September, is celebrating his 40th year in power since 1969. Okay, is this going to change? Well, first of all, let's not forget, we have seen there is some change in some places. Okay, some of them are well known and some of them are not. Obviously, the United States imposed change in Iraq, but we now do see the development of an Iraqi system that is definitely more open to political competition, more democratic. Iraq has many, many problems, many still obviously many problems with internal violence and there are many issues. I don't want to say everything in Iraq is perfect, but there is now, you know, a democratic system developing that. And the most recent example we saw of that were the elections in the province of Kurdistan, which were very successful, I think, and actually brought an opposition movement into significant representation in the Kurdish parliament. So there's Iraq. There's also the Palestinian territories. And again, it's a very messy situation there. The conflict between Israel and the Palestinians on one hand and the Arab states on the other goes on. But there has been a change there, and you see real contestation of power in the Palestinian territories. In a couple of other countries, we also see real competition for power. Lebanon is one of them. Another one that I would point out is Kuwait, where the elected Kuwaiti parliament has over time become increasingly important and has gained a lot of power and a lot of leverage vis-a-vis the ruling family in Kuwait. So there are some places in the Arab world where you don't have a single strong man in power. But that is still the case in most Arab countries. The very notable thing about Arab political systems is most of them give a great deal of power to the executive branch of government as opposed to the legislative or the judicial branches, and within the executive branch, often to one person, whether it's a president or a king, and that person in almost every case is not freely elected. There may be an electoral process, but in most cases it's very much a controlled competition among a very small group, if that. So that is the thing that I think people in the Arab world, reformers, civil society movements, opposition movements, are trying to change. And that is really the big question as to whether that kind of thing is going to change. Because if all the power is vested in the hands of someone who is not accountable to the citizens via the ballot box, then there are a lot of negative ripple effects throughout the society, the economy, et cetera.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you mentioned the Palestinian territories, because it seems that there is a place where people have decided, you know, they've sort of said, well, I'm not really quite sure. We're not sure what's going to happen here politically. We're not sure what's happening between us and the Israelis. But one thing we do want to do is try to develop the economy. So we're going to try to put those other things aside, and we're going to say, well, that's something we have to do, and we have to do for ourselves. And they have been moving on that.
Well, in the West Bank and Gaza, of course, there is this serious rift, all right, between Fatah, which is the faction of Yasser Arafat, the leading faction in the Palestinian Liberation Organization. They're the secular nationalists, and Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement. So Hamas, since 2007, has literally been in control in Gaza, and Fatah in the West Bank. So this is a very serious and painful rift. And certainly in the economies, you see an enormous difference. There is international assistance going in both to the West Bank and Gaza. But in Gaza, it's generally very basic humanitarian assistance and basic sort of some basic rebuilding of Gaza. In the West Bank, it's much more development assistance and so forth, and they're beginning to feel the effects of it. But I have to say, I really think for Palestinians, the political issue and the issue of the conflict with Israel remains number one. It's basically, you know, international assistance that has kept the Palestinians from suffering the full consequences of this ongoing conflict. Certainly, they suffer serious consequences, economic consequences of the ongoing conflict. But it's been mitigated by the international community, led by the United States, really pouring pouring assistance, particularly into the West Bank. But I think everyone knows that there's not going to be any kind of real viable economy, Palestinian economy, until this conflict with Israel is settled somehow, and most likely settled through the creation of a Palestinian state. Even then, it's going to be quite challenging, because if there is a Palestinian state created in the West Bank and Gaza, it will be more or less landlocked and small, and it's going to be very dependent on its relations with its neighbors, with Israel and with Jordan and with Egypt for Gaza, in order to, for example, get goods in and out. So, you know, having a successful Palestinian economy is going to be a big challenge.
Have countries in the region looked at Europe and looked at the experience of the EU and what has happened there with the goal of some kind of economic unification of the countries in the region? Do people in the Middle East look at that and say, you know, that might be a model for us?
Well, what I would say is that there are a number of countries in the Middle East that would love to get into the EU itself. You know, I think especially the countries along the Mediterranean, the North African countries such as Morocco and Tunisia, and countries like Israel and Egypt have close economic ties with Europe. Europe is the major trading partner for most of them, and they would love it if there's some way for them to get into the European Union. I don't think that's in the offing. Many of them have these association agreements with Europe that facilitate trade. In terms of some sort of an economic union in the Middle East, there have been several unsuccessful attempts at this so far. There have been many attempts. There is the Gulf Cooperation Council, and there have been attempts to integrate the Gulf a little bit more economically. There was a big attempt on the part of the United States at one point to foster a North African economic union. And during the 1990s, when people were very hopeful about the Arab-Israeli peace process, there was a lot of talk about some sort of Middle Eastern economic union that would include Israel. The big problem with all of this is that the economies in the Middle East don't tend to be as complementary as the economies in Europe are. They tend to be too similar to each other. You yourself noted, David, the very limited number of industries in most of these countries, and that there's some of the same industries in all of them. So to make them trading partners for each other has never, so far, made a great deal of sense.
All right, let's talk with a caller here in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting talk, and I appreciate the caller's insight. A question and a comment. You mentioned the development in the turn of the 19th century. One of the comments is, or rather histories, is there was no Arab world after World War I. Now, we know that three men, Wilson, U.S. president, the British prime minister, and the French, met at Versailles after World War I and created the modern Arab world. They're all artifacts. There was no Saudi Arabia. The French owned North Africa. The British were interested in the center. The United States never had a presence. So there were two empires from ancient times, Persian and Turkish, different religious sects. So my comment is that how do we expect these regimes or these modern countries to react when, in fact, the creations of three Western countries or three Western statesmen? And we do know from history that, for example, Saudi Arabia was a gift to a sheik because he aided the British during the World War I. And so the other thing, too, is, and this is the question, really the Renaissance was after Muhammad or the prophet. And you're right that the Arab world had things like electric lights way before the West did in Baghdad and so forth and so on. And they seem to have just disappeared from history after the Crusades and after the Spanish Moor or after the Catholic Spain threw them out of Spain. And they were a great they did very well in Spain. They were very tolerant of religions. Anyhow, just curious to hear your comments on that.
All right. Well, particularly, I think one must acknowledge the way that the shape of the Middle East now was determined by what happened after World War I with the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and the movement of a number of European powers into the region, carving up the territory into their spheres of influence, and we still see that today. They went in there where there had been a blank map, and they took out rulers and they drew lines, and those lines still stand.
Yes, I think the caller is certainly right about the legacy of World War I. I teach a course at Georgetown about the Middle East and the modern Middle East, and actually I always start with World War I because I think it's terribly important for the students to understand what happened during World War I and how we still feel the effects of that today, certainly in the Arab-Israeli issue and other issues as well. Now, the point about the Arab states being artificial artificial entities and creations of the West, I think, let me say, I agree and I disagree, okay? Mm-hmm. I agree that that was the case at the time after World War I, and it certainly is true. There is this famous agreement between France and Britain, who were the major colonial powers, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, in which they sat down, they carved up spheres of influence in the Middle East, and they carved up sort of states that were based at their understanding, a combination of their understanding of the time of kind of tribal affiliations and groups of people, and also their own interests as the French and the British, the groups with whom they had relationships and so forth. And they carved it up into states that are more or less what we see today. But I do think that over time, many of the countries in the Middle East have gained much more of a national consciousness. Some of them always had it. Places like Egypt, for example, there was always a strong sense of Egyptian identity. And you know, however the borders were drawn, Egyptians knew that they were Egyptians. In other countries, this may have been less so. I think Iraq, for example, was sort of artificially cobbled together, and we saw some of those fault lines reemerge after the recent U.S. invasion of Iraq. But interestingly, even now we see a reemergence of Iraqi nationalism and the country hanging together, you know, the predictions of a couple of years ago that the country was going to fall apart into these Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish regions, that it had never been a real country and so forth. We heard that a couple of years ago. You don't hear it so much now. And actually, those have been more successful in Iraqi politics and Iraqi elections recently are the nationalists who want to hold the country together. So I think that there are a lot of countries where over time, let's face it, it's been, almost 100 years since World War I, and that the sense of nationalism has emerged. In that recent Economist article that you were mentioning, they looked at this question a little bit, some polling from the Arab world, and how do people see themselves? How do you identify yourself first, as a citizen of your country or an Arab or a Muslim or something else? And a citizen of your country did come in first. The other, you know, some people saying, well, I'm an Arab first or I'm a Muslim first. Those were also strong, but I was surprised to see how strongly people identified themselves first and foremost as, you know, Lebanese or Algerian or the citizen of a particular country.
We're coming down to about our last 5-6 minutes very quickly to introduce our guest, Michelle Dunn. She is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's an expert on Arab politics and U.S. policy. We have another caller here. We'll go right there to line number one, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. Well, there's so much to take issue with and there's so little time, so I'll pick one, I guess. Well, as a forward, though, there's an old saying about the Middle East that you have oil, you have water. Iraq is pivotal in that it's got both, so that's why it's been such a prize and why the neocons are frankly, who write the books about empire, are frankly, you know, clear that that's why it has to be in the American U.S. theater, and I'm sure you'll dismiss all of that, but. You said that there's moderate reconstruction going on in Gaza. That's outrageous. Gaza is being strangled by U.S.-Israeli policy. People are dying from lack of water. They have the highest rates of dying from renal failure because they just don't get good water. The water is being pumped out, and salt water is coming into the... It's ghastly. There's so many misrepresentations of the situation. I'm no fondness of any fundamentalist, free market or Christian or Islamic, but the true story of the Hamas takeover was that the U.S. and Israel weren't going to countenance it, and they started arming Dalit through Elliot Abrams' channels to overthrow Hamas forcibly, and that's when Hamas started a battle with Fatah because they knew what was coming. And that's heretical in the American environment, and it sounds like it's coming from Neptune, but that's I'm just talking past you and asking people in the audience to poke around a little bit in this subject because there's a lot here that's not being unpacked. Thank you.
Dr. Dunn, you respond however
you
like.
Yeah, let me just respond. I actually didn't discuss how the Hamas takeover happened, but I more or less agree with what the caller said. It is true that after Hamas won in the parliamentary elections of 2006, the Bush administration at first took what I would, you know, a kind of a principled position saying, yes, we agree these were legitimate elections and that Hamas is elected, but no, we can't give them our taxpayers' money because we consider them a terrorist organization. But it is true that after that, the United States went around and tried to get, you know, the rest of the world not to fund Hamas, which is, you know, a terrorist organization according to our law, and also did arm Fatah against Hamas. And I think it's accurate that Hamas preemptively started a fight with Fatah because they saw this happening, and so they started this fight and they ended up, you know, with control of Gaza. So I do think that's true. I had simply mentioned the Hamas takeover of Gaza without talking about what, you know, exactly what had led to it.
Anything else you want to say in response to what the caller had to say about living conditions for people in Gaza?
They are extremely poor. I agree. They are extremely poor. I think I mentioned that there's a great disparity. That's the first thing I said. There's a great disparity between the economic conditions in Gaza and the West Bank, and that there is some minimal, you know, international economic assistance going into Gaza, mostly humanitarian, but that the real, you know, there is much, much more money going into the West Bank with a view toward, you know, the United States is still trying to strengthen Fatah and the secular nationalist Palestinians against Hamas. And one of the ways they're trying to do this is by making an economic success out of the West Bank as compared to Gaza.
We're coming down. We have a couple of minutes left, and maybe I would just ask you to talk about something slightly different, but I know it's something that you have thought about and have written about, and maybe you could spend a couple of minutes talking about the Obama administration's Middle East policy and perhaps make some comparisons between the Obama approach to the Middle East and the Bush approach to the Middle East.
Well, there's been a very big change, I think, both in the way the administration sees the Middle East and the specific actions they're taking. In general, what I would say is that Obama has returned Middle East policy to something very similar to what it was before the Bush administration. And that's not something that's specifically Democratic. I mean, both Democratic and Republican administrations had followed largely the same policy in the Middle East for many years with a few variations. But they definitely did see the Arab-Israeli issue as the central issue and one in which the United States should exert energy in one way or another to resolve. And so they saw that, and then they were concerned about stability in the Gulf and maintaining the free access of oil. The Bush administration, from the time it came in, but especially after the 9/11 attacks, really turned this on its head and took a very different approach to the Middle East, which was, no, the Arab-Israeli conflict is not central, and we're really much more concerned about troublemakers like Iraq and Iran and what we can do to contain them, and we know everything that came from that. So Obama has returned it more to what U.S. policy had been for a long time, and he moved out very fast in his first year on the Arab-Israeli front. He's appointed an envoy, and there's a pretty brisk pace of diplomatic activity. I don't know if it will succeed. I'm not necessarily predicting that it will succeed, but they're devoting a lot of energy to it, which was not what the Bush administration did, at least in Bush's first 6 years in office.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in your comment that the policy is we're returning to the kind of policy that was in effect before Bush. I'm moved to ask, do you think that, in fact, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is important in that policy, and what we're seeing is something of a return to the approach that the Clinton administration took?
Yes. We are seeing an approach pretty much very similar to the Clinton administration, but not only the Clinton administration. The policy of President Bush Sr., in the Middle East was similar. I don't want to say identical, but pretty similar, actually, to what Clinton then did. So it wasn't something that President Clinton, invented. He was continuing an approach, more or less, that had been followed for a long time. So, yes, I think Secretary Clinton is important here. It seems that she and President Obama are pretty much on the same page when it comes to Middle East. There are some differences. I mean, I think that Secretary Clinton is perceived to be a bit more hawkish when it comes, for example, to Iran and the need to prevent Iran from attaining a nuclear weapon. And perhaps on, you know, whether or not the United States should talk to groups like Hamas, which we consider terrorist groups. She's seen as a little bit more hawkish on those things than President Obama is.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michelle Dunn. She is senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she is also editor of the Arab Reform Bulletin. Dr. Dunn, thank you very much.
You're welcome.